Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is, our speaker is Leland Faust. Our program, How Wall Street is Destroying America. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Leland and then I'm going to bring him up here. We will be using audience question cards, so please fill those out and pass them to the ushers. Leland Faust is an honors graduate from both the University of California, Berkeley in Economics and the Harvard Law School. He was the founder of and from 78 through 2011 served as the Chief Investment Officer of CSI Capital Management, where he supervised over $1.5 billion in assets. From 1997 through 2010, he was the Senior Portfolio Manager of the CSI Equity Fund, a publicly traded mutual fund which was recognized as a top-performing equity fund by the Wall Street Journal and USA Today. Barron's has named Leland to its annual list every year he was eligible of the top 100 mutual fund managers. From 2007 through 2010, which were the only years he was eligible, he was selected by Barron's for its list of the top 100 independent investment advisors in the country. He's also been named to the Sporting News list of the 100 most powerful people in sports, one of only two investment advisors ever to be included in that roster. Please welcome Leland Faust.
Thank you. As I was preparing for this talk, someone suggested that I look at Burning Wall Street, which turned out to be part of the 2012 Burning Man get-together in the desert. And they had spent $100,000 to build replicas up to 90 feet tall of the headquarters of Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, the Bank of America, and Chase Manhattan Bank. And at the end of the week, they torched them, and the crowd cheered. I don't think they knew the details of what Wall Street was doing, but they certainly sensed that something was wrong and they were frustrated and angry. Well, they were symbolically destroying Wall Street, but I think we're going to discuss how Wall Street is much more destroying America. Now, my views on this didn't begin, as others have, with the 2007-2008 crash or the downturn with the dot-com bust in 2000. Rather, in 1978, I started a firm, and I started collecting clippings of Wall Street actions that seemed to make no sense to me. And from those files and my personal experience and observations of over 35 years of representing real people with their real finances and their real lives at stake, I've come to conclude that Wall Street, as it is today, is toxic. The 2011 bankruptcy of a firm called MF Global, which was the eighth largest bankruptcy in American history, prompted me to write an op-ed which was published. And it summarized a lot of what I thought was wrong. One was the cult of the Wall Street superstar. Two, gambling disguised as investing. The bail-me-out syndrome, enormous conflicts of interest. Leverage, borrowing money on a grand scale, failure of regulators and the reform laws, misappropriation of client funds, worthless rating agencies, golden parachutes and compensation soaring high, and the breakdown of morality, which caused it all to happen. And we're not talking about something that's isolated. I think it's an insidious pattern. And you can find it every day if you just read the financial press. It's there for you every day, the problems. So I'm going to ask you to do with respect to Wall Street what the rapper Public Enemy said in a different context, which is, don't believe the hype. Wall Street is destroying America. And I know that's a strong statement, but I don't think it's hyperbole. It's changing the culture. It used to be hard work, long term would be rewarded, productive investment. Now it's gambling and get rich quick. This distorts the allocation of capital and it distorts brain where brain power is deployed too. It's bankrupting or impairing pension plans and 401k plans and Section 529 college savings plans. It's threatening the banking system, and we need a functioning banking system to have a modern economy that works. It's making it difficult for investors to be long-term, which is more productive and safer. It's taking huge amounts of money out of the productive economy and putting it into the non-productive pockets of players on Wall Street. It's requiring huge bailouts, which then threaten other government programs where the money could be used in a much better way. Makes us less competitive in the world. It's created a culture of debt that's totally out of control. And if you have debt that you can't repay, civilizations have literally fallen because of that. It's breeding a lack of trust and reinforcing the idea that special interests get special treatment. And that leads to class warfare, which has been lacking in America, at least. And I haven't seen as much of it in my lifetime as I do now. And I think it's because of this. The free enterprise system, in my view, has been hijacked. People write that the free enterprise or the capitalist system has failed. And I don't think that's what's happened. I think it's been hijacked, and I'll explain why. It infuriates me. We've had this great system that really produces the greatest amount of economic prosperity for the most. If you don't like free enterprise, please turn in your iPad. Don't go to Google today and don't watch CNN, among other things. I'm not Michael Moore. I believe in this system. And as my introduction says, I think I've succeeded in it. I'm not someone who fails and rails. But I would like to point out two things so you understand my position and where I come from to a degree. One, we need a functioning Wall Street. We need that to raise capital, to help companies grow, to raise debt, and we need it to make liquid markets for those instruments. So it's not that Wall Street can go away and we'll all be fine. We just need it to function in a different way. And the next thing is that the government, in my view, is a huge part of this problem, maybe even bigger than Wall Street in terms of the threat in the long term. But we're not talking about that today. We're talking about the Wall Street contribution. We have now what I've referred to as the triumph of selfish interest. There's been a breakdown of morality, in my opinion, and people are doing what might be legal, but what's not right, and maybe we have to change what's legal. But nobody on Wall Street, or too few anyway, are exercising their fiduciary duty. Now, that's a legal term, and it means that you're supposed to act with other people's money as if it were your own. Client first, no excuses. Alan Greenspan, in testifying before Congress, said, and I quote, "I found a flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works," close quote. And that, he was saying, he believed self-interest would have made it such that Wall Street wouldn't have done what they did. Well, I disagree with him to an fairly significant extent on that quote. I think self-interest was alive and well, or as I've referred to as selfish interest. He thought that the executives of the firms would do what they were supposed to do and have the self-interest of their firms, and therefore they wouldn't do things that would jeopardize their firms. But their compensation packages and their ownership of stock packages were in conflict with the companies that they worked for. So they had the incentive to do what they did. Why is that? Because if they took these massive gambles and if they won, they won and got a huge part of the profits. And if they lost, somebody else paid for it. So things were out of balance. If you don't bear the consequence, if you're taking the risk, you do different things than you should. It's been called crony capitalism, private gains, socialized losses, heads I win, tails you lose. But nobody would do with their own money lots of things that happened on Wall Street. A few quick examples. It's absurd to think anybody would have made a subprime loan with their own money. Nobody with their own money and their whole net worth at stake would leverage it on a difficult gamble, 40 to 1, $40 of debt for every $1 of equity. So if the investment went down by 3%, they'd be wiped out. That's where the selfish interest took over for the self-interest and causes the problem. Now I want to turn to what I would call systemic rot that's everywhere in this Wall Street system. It involves all the major firms. It's not isolated. It's repeated. It's constant. It's at the highest level for what the CEOs and the boards are doing. Unfortunately, down to the lowest level, what the brokers are doing with their individual clients. And it's a toxic culture. Let me give you a few examples from the high level. Goldman Sachs arranged for a $6.8 billion off-market cross-currency swap to help Greece avoid the EU limits on debt. Well, it turns out it didn't help Greece for very long, but it did help Goldman Sachs make $300 million fee on that transaction. Goldman Sachs also, for the benefit of one of its good clients who wanted to bet against the subprime mortgages, set up a fund for him, which he asked, give me the worst mortgage you can possibly find so I can bet against them. They said, fine. They set it up, and then they turned around and sold it to their own clients as a good investment. UBS was involved in hiding thousands of accounts from the U.S. government for foreign tax evasion. Barclays and HSBC, those are two different banks in England, manipulating the LIBOR interest rate on which so much depends. Bank of New York Mellon overcharging its biggest customers on foreign exchange for a long period of time, and it's estimated $2 billion of charges by just taking pennies here and pennies there on those transactions. J.P. Morgan trying to hide a $6 billion gambling loss, which they incurred. And MF Global, which I mentioned before, taking $1.2 billion of their clients' funds and moving it to their own account, which is illegal. Using inside information and insider information seems to be everywhere, creating needlessly complex products so they can charge more. How the shareholders do when all this was going on? Well, from 2001 through October 2012, I used that when I was preparing for the lecture, Citicorp, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and the Bank of New York Mellon, average stock price went down 68%. So they weren't doing a very good job of protecting the shareholders or the country when the bailouts came. Wells Fargo, by the way, went up 30%, so it was possible to do something right. And you can be a big bank and do things right, even in the environment we've had the last 10 years, if you choose to. There were four large banks who averaged 75% increase in the value of their stock over the exact same time period. Those happen to be the four largest banks in Canada. It's a giant casino out there. Gambling has taken over much too much for productive investment. What's investing? Putting your money to productive use. You own something rather than just owning a bet with somebody else. You know, you own a stock, you own a piece of an enterprise. In an investment transaction, it's certainly possible both parties can make money. I can own a stock, buy it for something, sell it to someone higher, he can buy it, hopefully sell it higher later on. As opposed to gambling, where one party wins, one party loses the exact same amount. They're trying to outsmart one another. Gambling involves, and I'm going to use a technical math term that will explain it, a zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is when all the players in the game start and end with the same amount of money. So an easy example is a poker game in your home. All the players start with something, they end collectively with the same amount. It's just been moved around. No wealth has been created or can be created. Wall Street's a negative-sum game when you are investing in these gambling opportunities because the players are betting one against the other, but then there are fees and commissions that come out to Wall Street. It's akin to the casinos in Las Vegas raking the poker pool. So another question that I ask, it doesn't always solve it, but would this be legal if it were done in a private transaction, or would it be an illegal gambling transaction under California law? Let's take a look at that. I can sell you a stock in a private transaction, or sell you a bond, that's no problem. But Apple computer is selling at about $590 a share today. We can't make a bet when I say it's going to go up 6 months from now, and you know, you say no, you say it's going to go down, loser pays. That's an illegal bet in California. But that's exactly how certain stock options work. That's exactly how short sales work. A short sale is a way of selling something that you don't own, hence a short sale, and buying it back later at what you hope is a lower price. So you buy a stock at $60 a share with the hope that it goes to $50, you make a $10 profit. But someone's on the other side of that who incurs the loss if you're lucky enough to make the profit. And, of course, it can go against you. You can buy it at $60, and if it goes to $75, you're going to lose $15. Well, short sales are increasing in their applicability or how much there are out there because the hedge funds use them. We'll talk about those later. Certain exchange-traded mutual funds are using them. Brokers are encouraging their clients to use them. And as I said, it would be illegal for us to make a private $1,000 bet on what's the equivalent of a short sale. But if I have $100 million, I can do that on Wall Street. It's perfectly fine. Now, there are excuses offered by Wall Street for the short sales. They say, well, if people sell short and it's known and there are public records of how much is sold short on every stock, then it exposes fraud or it exposes companies that aren't being run as well as they should and puts pressure on them to do the right thing. Well, maybe, but you could post it on the internet or you could just sell your stock and you don't have to be involved in a gambling transaction where just because you've discovered that you want to try to take money from someone who's not as well informed as you, assuming you're right. And so it's a gambling technique in my view, and it's just an example of it. And I have one question that so far no one's been able to answer. If the idea is a short sale is to put pressure on fraudulent companies or poorly run companies, why can you sell short a United States Treasury bond? Are we punishing the government for borrowing money at lower interest than you think they should be paying? Publicly traded options are kind of the same thing. They're gambling. Wall Street says they limit your losses because you can buy an option on a stock for a small percentage of the stock price. I think it's just the opposite. I think it magnifies your losses. If you buy a stock for $60 and it goes to $54, you've lost 10% of your money. If you buy an option on that same stock and it goes from 60 to 54 and you paid $5 for the option, you've lost only $5. That's true, but you've also lost 100% of what you had in the game. And that's being pushed and pushed more and more over the years. Let's take a quick look at derivatives. We've heard that term. It floats around a lot. And derivatives, first of all, what are they? Well, in the most fundamental sense, they are a contract which derives its value from something else that you do not own. So it That's why they're called derivatives, because they derive their value. So let me give you, an example. You'll give me $3 today, and I'll give you $1,000 if General Electric defaults on its bonds within the next 2 years. They're sort of a typical credit default swap, they're called. Now, Wall Street says it's insurance, but if you don't own General Electric bonds, you're not insuring anything. And most of these credit default swaps and other derivatives are held by people who do not own the underlying investment. And if you think, well, how do you know that's so? Well, I can't do it in an individual case, but I can tell you that there's been an estimate that there are approximately $2 trillion worth of bonds that are subject to derivatives, and that the face amount of those derivatives are $10 trillion. So we've insured them five times over if that were the case. I think we also want to take a look at the hedge funds, which have gotten so much publicity recently. Hedge funds got their name originally because you were supposed to be hedging your bets. They were supposed to be more balanced. You had things that would go up and down at different times under different circumstances. Well, that might have been true originally, but I don't think anymore. Today, most hedge funds, in my opinion, are just a way to gamble. They're just a wrapper around gambling. They use short sales. They use lots of debt. They trade short term instead of long term. They use options. They use derivatives. And what are all the risks associated with them, which everybody's so happy to disregard? Well, first is gambling. A lot of it is just the kind of gambling I described before. Another is a lot of them have no liquidity, meaning you can't get your money out quickly. With a stock and a bond, you can get your money out right away. Hedge funds typically can't, which means that the owners of them control your money for longer. Fees are much higher. We're going to talk about that. There's a lot of borrowing and leverage, which makes them difficult and more risky. And there's no transparency in a lot of them, which means you can't see what you own. It's a big, dark secret from the hedge fund operator in many cases. It was observed by a business school professor that a hedge fund is a compensation structure disguised as an asset class. Everybody's saying you must have hedge funds, and I completely agree. Why do you say that? Well, a typical, if I call myself an investment advisor and I have massive amounts of money, depending on what I'm doing, maybe I can get 1% of the money a year I'm managing, maybe 0.5%, maybe 0.25%. It depends on how long and how long I do it and what I'm investing in. The hedge funds typically gets called what's 2 and 20, 2% every year of the money under management, and 20% of the profits if they're profits. And all the evidence that I have seen indicates that the average hedge fund underperforms the stock and bond indexes. So on average, people are paying these higher fees for poorer performance. We've got the right now syndrome involved in what's going on. It used to be that Wall Street was looking for longer-term investing. Not anymore. Now it's short-term gambling. Turn over as fast as you possibly can. Well, I think it can be substantiated that the shorter your horizon is, the more things are random. Over the last 100 years, approximately 70 of those years were up years for the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones averages. But there were 30 down years. And in the up years, there were lots of down months and down days. But Wall Street wants you to do this because they want to increase their trading volume. And that's, important to them. The other thing this is doing is it's putting pressure on companies to worry about the short term instead of the long term. And so they're making decisions which may not be in the company's best interest for the long run, but will look good in the short run, and therefore they won't be attacked by Wall Street, or the corporate stock options will be worth more, because if in the short term the stock goes up and they have options that they can exercise today, they want them up today, they want to exercise them today, and what happens in 5 years is somebody else's problem. I want to turn now to what I would refer to as the abuse of credit. Debt is fine. debt's needed in order to have a functioning economy in the modern world. But debt of that sort needs to have a reasonable path to repay. And if it doesn't, then it exposes both the buyer, or the creditor, pardon me, and the debtor to a lot of risk. It's debt that caused the 2008 crash to be so great and be called the Great Recession and lead to it. As one party was indebted to the other, indebted to the other, indebted to the other. So it starts to cascade down. Whereas in the dot-com bust in 2000 through 2002, it didn't happen because most of that was done with equity financing and there wasn't a lot of debt to cascade down. Debt's gotten totally out of control. Margin accounts are another way that it is and that Wall Street's encouraging. A margin account is when you borrow money so that you can buy more of what you otherwise have less to do. So you could buy $1,000 with your equity, but you can buy $2,000 worth of something if you borrow $1,000 from the brokerage firm. Well, now they can get twice the commissions, and they can also charge you interest, which they do on the mortgage, on the debt, and that's an absolutely risk-free loan that they're making. There's also the perverse incentive that's leading to massive debt because of the way compensation structures are working. If you have $1 billion that you're managing for your Wall Street firm and you get paid a certain percentage of the profit, well, if you borrow $20 billion and then make the same percentage profit, your compensation just went up 20 times. And if you lose, somebody else pays the bill, either the shareholders or the government. So you have every incentive to do it, and that's what's been going on for some time now. Wall Street overcharging customers and clients is another problem that's certainly out there. Now, certainly everybody's entitled to a fair fee for services. That's the question, of course, what's a fair fee? Well, we all have the answer. A fair fee is what I charge, not 1 cent more. But when you overcharge, you suck money out of this productive system, and you take it from many and give it to a few. And this really matters. Pension funds then end up with less money. Take a little bit every year for 30 years. It adds up. How does this happen? Well, I think it happens in part because of lack of the customers understanding what is available, how much they can negotiate, what products they should buy that are cheaper, etc. It also happens because some of the pension funds and others are, in fact, themselves playing with other people's money, and they don't really care what the fees are as long as they can substantiate that they're what the market is. These overcharging comes about in many ways, more volume than is necessary, encouraging people to trade and trade and trade, needless complexity in the instruments so that there's less understanding of what you're buying and the market isn't as clear and therefore you can hide more commissions. Higher markups on bonds, they don't have to tell you. When you buy a bond, it says you bought a bond for $1,020 unless you ask. The trade slip doesn't tell you what you paid. A lot gets hidden there. Higher markups on those bonds, derivatives, the hedge funds, which are able to charge the 20% upside fee, in most cases, even if they underperform the averages. So if the S&P goes up 20% and the hedge fund goes up 15%, they still collect their 20%. Of the profit. It's an ongoing problem. It's been with mutual funds having all kinds of classes of shares. Those classes of shares are all the same in terms of the underlying investment, but they sure have a heck of a difference in the compensation. We also have the problem that I would refer to as sky-high compensation in the aggregate. And again, this is Wall Street and some of corporate America sucking huge amounts out of the system year after year after year, and it adds up. If you've been getting eight-figure bonuses, and some people have, from these financial firms that I've talked about, and you've been doing it year after year after year for 10 years, and the stock on average went down 68%, who's winning? Now, I have no objection to large amounts of wealth. Bill Gates is entitled to it. He started a massive enterprise and changed the world. The Walton family, the founders of Google. But that's different than being paid for taking risks with somebody else's money. Sometimes they don't even understand the risks. And if you're lucky, being able to collect. The average CEO of a S&P 500 company now is making somewhere between $10 and $15 million a year. A lot of that's in stock options. And they do everything they can, as I would if I were there, to protect those stock options. So the company may suffer, but they want their stock options protected. How overpaid are some of these people? Well, an easy example, but there are lots of others, is the compensation to the head of General Motors before it went into bankruptcy and then bailout. Everybody at that point knew that GM was, you know, floundering. But the CEO in a year prior, just prior to the bailout, earned more than the CEO of Toyota Motors in Japan, which was building the biggest auto company in the world and was highly profitable. Well, you say, well, so the guy in America made more than the guy in Japan. Well, that's true, but the guy in America also made more than the 25 highest paid employees of Toyota put together. The hedge fund compensation is another thing. I have some figures here for what the top five hedge fund operators made in 2009. Now, they made this on the 20% fee that they get because some of them made really good bets on the subprime that and collected that year. But you don't have to pay it back. That's the good news for them if you flounder in other years, which I guess is good news for the person who came in number four on the list in 2009, because in 2011, his fund was down 47%, while the S&P 500 was up 2%. But anyway, the top five in 2009 made an aggregate of 13.6 or 2.7 each. You say, well, Leland, what's the deal? You know, 2.7 each. 2.7 billion each. And to put that in perspective, the five of them made $13.6 billion. Every professional hockey, basketball, football, and baseball player in America makes less than $13.6 billion by quite a bit. And then these folks have the audacity, and I use that word advisedly, to fight the reform to close the tax loophole which enables them for their compensation for their services of running this, these funds to be taxed in part at capital gains rates rather than ordinary income rates. So they pay 20% less tax on a lot of their income, and they don't pay Medicare tax on that income. I'd like to turn now to a topic which I call Wall Street pornography. It's the shameless promotion and hype and hucksterism that goes on constantly on Wall Street. This isn't really anything new, but they're there to entice you and excite you and get you to lust after imagined riches. It's the cult of the Wall Street superstar and worthless predictions and conflicted advice and purposely misleading your clients. People will say, well, what's the harm? Well, what's the harm if you don't understand who you're listening to, you buy risky things that you otherwise wouldn't? You take advice from people who are pretending to know and who don't. You take advice from people who previously have succeeded only because they were lucky and not skillful, and that leads to losses. So now we're going to dip into those, some of those files I talked about and give you a few examples of Wall Street pornography. I have the cover of Fortune magazine from July of 2000. And I know this goes back a ways, but it illustrates the point so well, we have to look at it. This is Fortune magazine's first annual Fortune All-Star Analyst. Top picks from the smartest guys on Wall Street. Let Them Make You Rich. That used to be in red letters, but it's by my window so long it's now no longer red. Anyway, They asked the 15 experts, their best analysts, and no more than two were from one firm. They were all from the biggest firms on Wall Street, to pick their two best stocks so you could put together a portfolio. That's how you were going to get rich. Well, in the 2 years following this, I pulled this out of the file, and it was a bad year, bad couple of years, because this was during the dot-com bust. And Wall Street, the Standard & Poor's 500 index, was down 37%. But fortunately, the Fortune All-Stars, their portfolio was down 63%. There's Bill Miller, who was a superstar manager of Legg Mason Value Fund. From 1991 through 2005, 15 years in a row, his fund beat the S&P 500 index. It was a record, never been beaten. He was a manager of the decade for Morningstar, the fundraising company. But the streak ended in 2006. And from 2006 to 2011, he lost to the S&P 5 out of 6 years. And he lost so much that he gave away all of the excess performance during the 15 years. He retired at the end of 2011. And the last 5 years of his fund, there were 858 funds in the category where Legg Mason Value is placed. And his fund was 857th out of the eight. So there might be that he had a system that worked one time, but it didn't work in another. And if you fell for it and were a victim of the cult of the superstar, you were in trouble. I had to dip into my files. I didn't have to. I chose to. I literally randomly went to my files and said, let's pull something from way back and see what happened. And I pulled this, which happened to be the cover in the magazine, Fortune magazine, December of 1994. Had a very unusual cover. It said, stocks, bear market ahead, ? It is really, really unusual for Wall Street, because of the Wall Street pornography, to ever suggest that things will go bad, because people don't want to invest if things are going to go bad. But when you opened up the article, it said, well, they had done their study, and bonds look like a much better investment than stocks. Well, over the next 5 years, bonds went up about 8%, pardon me, about 9% a year, the bonds they were talking about in the article. Stocks, however, for the next 5 years, went up 29% per year for the best 5 years in American history. We get all kinds of other advice from all kinds of experts. I'm just going to pull one here. This was a number of years ago. But Sun Microsystem probably has the best near-term outlook of any company I know. In the next 4 months, it went down 50%. In the next 2 years, it went down 95%. Jim Cramer's advice. I want to turn quickly to the question of enforcement missing in action, because I think that's what's happened. Why has regulations failed legislatively? The regulations, the enforcement, they've all failed. And in part, it's because of the great political pressure which these companies can bear. Here's an article from the New York Times in November of 2011. As regulators pressed changes, Corzine pushed back. Corzine was the head of the MF Global Company, which I told you about, the eighth largest bankruptcy in American history. Before that, he was chairman for many years of Goldman Sachs and the governor of New Jersey. And then later on, when the $1.2 billion, which is some of it still unaccounted for, the Wall Street Journal reports no criminal case is likely for Corzine's firm. Now, I don't know whether John Corzine himself knew enough to be personally responsible on a criminal level, but somebody authorized that $1.2 billion to be transferred, and they're walking. And Martha Stewart went to jail for a small trade on insider information. So you wonder why it's not doing it. Working. The regulatory fines don't have any effect because they're the proverbial, slap on the wrist, but they're a slap on the wrist that somebody else is paying for. The executives make all the money, then the company pays for it. And they pay nothing. Goldman Sachs had to pay a fine of $550 million recently. They paid $12 billion in bonuses the same year. How much did that hurt? Citicorp had to pay a fine recently, $285 million. That's one-third of 1% of what their income is. They have a bureaucracy that's only interested in having their own jobs protected and checking boxes on forms that they've complied with the regulations, and they don't worry about what the real substance is. I have a personal war story on that one. Years ago, an auditor came in, government auditor, as they do, they come in unannounced if you're an investment advisory firm. And he said to me, he was an older guy, he's probably a lot younger than I am now, but he said, well, you know how this is going to go. And I said, no, I don't know how it's going to go. How's it going to go? He said, well, I'm going to poke around here for a few days. He said, I'm going to find a technical violation or two. There's so many little rules, and they're so arcane. There's no way I'm not going to find it. So then I'm going to write you a letter, and I'm going to tell you that this is a problem, and then either you or your lawyer are going to write me back a letter saying, gee, we're sorry, and we're going to fix it, and that'll be the end of it. Then he said, after all, we know that the guys that are really cheating don't register, so I can't audit them. Where would I, how would I summarize this? Well, I would summarize this by saying a number of things. One, the system's never been perfect, but I think it's worked better in the past. And all these new and improved products really aren't doing anything. The former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, and say he said this a few years ago, so you're going to have to add to the 25 years that he refers to. He was asked about the innovations from the banks and Wall Street. And he said the only lasting value in innovation that the banks had come up with in the last 25 years was the ATM. Now, I'm not advocating a return to the good old days of yesteryear. But everybody thinks the best time to own stocks was in the 1990s and the dot-com, and as I told you, the five best years were in the 90s. But actually, the best decade to own stocks was the 1950s. And how were the 1950s different, and why did those stocks go up without all these wonderful inventions that Wall Street's come up with? Well, the answer was because companies were growing rapidly, earnings were growing, sales were growing, and companies were worth more because of that. But back then, there were no options for the executives, either none or de minimis. There were no publicly traded options. The CEOs made about 30 times what the average worker made, not 300 times. There was a lower volume of trades. There were little short sales, not a lot. There was no day trading. There were no derivatives, much less debt. Obviously, no computer trading. There was adequate liquidity. There was no hype on IPOs. There were no 2 and 20 fees. There were no hedge funds. There were no guidance on earnings. You had to wait for a real earnings report. There was much less accounting fraud because people weren't trying to push and push for the very moment. Obviously, there were no 24/7 pundits because there wasn't television like that. The commercial banks and the investment banks were separated. And most important, and maybe the summary of a lot of the above, there was much less gambling. There was investing. Well, what can we do about this? Well, I think there's a lot at stake if Wall Street's not cleaned up. Now, first of all, the whole system can be impaired by overregulation, so we've got to be careful about that, too. But there could also be a populist revolt. And if there's another problem like there was in 2008, I would think that the Occupy movement is going to be a whole lot bigger and a whole lot deeper. We need to stop gambling. I think we need to outlaw a lot of the things which are there, short sales and derivatives and options, and start investing. Warren Buffett has been on board for doing some of those things. We need to put limits on systemic risky debt. We need to restore a long-term horizon. I would place a high tax on short-term profits or a very meaningful transaction tax so that we can slow down the volume here. And again, where the Wall Street says if you put a transaction tax on, you'll kill all of the value of the stocks. Well, there wasn't a transaction tax in the 1950s, but the average commission to buy and sell a stock was about 1.5% instead of essentially nothing today. And then that 1.5% commission didn't seem to hurt performance in the 50s. We need reasonable fees and compensation. We need risk to be followed by the reward and no socialized losses and private gain. We need regulations that address the real problems and not just bureaucracy. We need to stop paying attention to Wall Street pornography. Turn on a comedy channel instead. You'll save a lot of money. And we need real criminal and civil penalties on the bad actors themselves, not just on the companies that they represent, so that the shareholders, or in the worst case, the government, ends up paying for their foolishness. If we do these things as best we can, and a lot of them would be hard to accomplish, but we sure ought to try, then I think our great free enterprise system can regain its footing, and there will be more prosperity for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Leland. Our program today is Leland Faust speaking on how Wall Street is destroying America. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. We have a lot of audience questions. I'm going to do my best to consolidate them and get them out. We will be ending just a few minutes after 1 o'clock. So, Leland, number one question, why isn't anybody in jail?
Well, interestingly enough, there was a report in the Chronicle very recently that criminal securities prosecutions are at a two-decade low. And I think that they're not in jail because of the great power and influence that these Wall Street firms have, that they use their influence to make sure that there aren't criminal prosecutions, and there hasn't been a history of it. And if there hasn't been a history of it, it's hard to get people excited to do it. So I think that a lot of it has been inertia. A lot of it is because the firms fight really hard to make sure that it doesn't happen.
What can the ordinary citizen do amid this arcane complexity to cause positive changes to straighten things up? And I think there were a number of other questions that say, what can we do rather than relying on strictly government regulation?
Well, if the question is, what can we do outside of government, I think part of it is, unfortunately, have to educate, educate yourself as best you can, which isn't easy because the press is complicit in so much of this. But I think one thing you can do is make sure, if you're investing your own money, that you're dealing with somebody who is legally a fiduciary, someone who legally has to put their client's interest ahead of their own, an independent advisor, not a firm that's charging you commissions or fees, but somebody who fees on transactions, but somebody who you pay a fee to manage your affairs. I think beyond that, it's a matter of asking questions. Some of the things that I've talked about, ask your broker what's the markup on a bond. He's got to tell you, and then see if that makes sense to you. Look at advertisements. See what's available elsewhere. Don't buy these complicated products. You don't need them. So I think that's part of it. Go with the tried and true. Own stocks, own bonds. There's certain types of mutual funds which are certainly very fine to own. If you're investing on your own, buy index funds, which an index fund is a fund that essentially tracks the entire market. So if you buy an S&P 500 index fund, you own those same 500 companies in the same proportion the S&P does. Most managers, strange but true, do not over time beat the S&P 500. So those fees on those are very low. But I think that, unfortunately, to really defeat this, it's going to have to be through legislation. Legislation doesn't work. We, in California, we could do initiatives, but that's a little bit expensive and a little bit scary.
All right, here's the big question. We have the election coming up next week, and that's why we scheduled this program today, to be right in touch with the election. So there's about 10 different questions, but basically, which candidate is more likely to reform Wall Street? And what about a Republican House or a Republican Senate or a Republican president versus a Democratic?
Well, I'm not an expert in political science, so I'd like to start there. But I think that this has been in the society, whether it's been Democratic Congresses or Republican Congresses, whether it's been Democratic presidents or Republican presidents, I think it's much less of a partisan thing than we'd like to believe, or some people would like to believe. It's been reported that the major Wall Street firms, which gave more money to Obama last time than they did to McCain, have shifted and have given much more to Romney than they are to Obama's reelection. I don't know what more they want that they didn't get, but it's been bipartisan. I railed in my a little bit in my ranted, I guess is a better word, in my presentation about the tax on the carried interest. Strange but true, during the George Bush administration, it appeared a bill was going to be passed to fix that, and it was killed by Senator Schumer, Democrat of New York. Well, we can figure out why. So it's not so clear that just having one party or the other will make a difference. And I think if we look over time, that's been the case.
Okay, we have another question that is emblematic of about 10 questions. It's very simply, okay then, where is the place to make a decent return today? And I think by implication, where's the place to make a decent return without screwing somebody else?
Well, I think there's a question, of course, of what's a decent return. One thing which has been a huge problem, and I did mention government before, but the government has had this policy, which so far they've been able to make happen, the Federal Reserve, of keeping interest rates very, very low. And what that means is you can't get essentially any reasonable return on a risk-free investment anymore. You can't buy treasury bills because they literally are paying you just a few hundredths of a percent. You know, not too long ago, you could take a risk-free return of 4 or 5% if you wanted to do that. So I think what you have to do today is to be careful not to use any of these gambling products. So you have to know what they are and stay away from them. You have to be willing, unfortunately, to accept a market rate of return. So if a high-quality short-term bond is only paying 2%, then you're going to have to be willing to accept that until the market conditions change. I think if you're a long-run player, there are certainly some high dividend-paying stocks or funds that invest in high dividend-paying stocks. That might be something you could do for a portion of your money. But you want to, if you're doing this yourself, you want to use, you probably are going to want to use low-cost mutual funds, and you're going to want to be diversified. And I think beyond that, there's no magic solution. What you want to be, I would say, be very, very careful of is extending bond maturities to get higher interest rates. You get more interest if you own a longer-term bond. But if inflation comes back, and I think a lot of people, myself included, think that it may, over time, if you own long-term bonds, you're going to be very sorry. So.
Do you see socially responsible investing, impact investing, triple bottom line, making its way into Wall Street? And why don't we see more of it at the moment? And then there was another question very similar to that one, asking about various kinds of alternative investing, alternative finance, non-dollar community, barter currencies. Do you see these as being beneficial or detrimental to our system?
Well, there's an awful lot of... An awful lot of questions there. I think that the alternatives, investing in things like foreign currencies, may make sense, but they have to be done very carefully. You really need to know what you're doing. I want to address the first part of your question, but it got so long, and you go back on that one.
Well, let's just go. The simple first question was: do you see socially responsible investing making its way into Wall Street?
Well, we've had the so-called socially responsible investing for a long time, and this is investing where we get companies or don't invest in companies that do things that whoever the screener is doesn't want. So they may be companies that don't pollute or aren't involved in tobacco or aren't involved in gambling or have what they think are better labor conditions and things of that nature. The history of those hasn't been very good in terms of relative performance, that you certainly have not improved your return by doing that. I think that we could do that with respect to owning the financial stocks. I own in our portfolios for our clients a very, very low percentage of the financial stocks because I don't want to own the companies that have done this particularly, and I don't want to own a bunch of companies that there but for the grace of the government would be out of business. So I think that it's been proven, I think, fairly hard for the socially responsible investing to have much of an impact unless there's an absolutely massive approach. And the people who could do something about this aren't. And those people are the operators of the massive funds. So if the heads of CalPERS were really serious about this, they could have an impact and they could get their compatriots and other state pension funds to do something about it, but they haven't seemed too interested in doing that. So I don't think that that's going to get us too far. And obviously from time to time there are mistakes too in what's a socially responsible. The Darling Oil Company, about the only major oil company you could own in a socially responsible fund for many years, was British Petroleum, and that was of course before the problems in the Gulf.
Okay, here's a very bottom, very nuts and bolts question. Where does the individual investor go to do reliable research on stocks and mutual funds? So in other words, how do we avoid Wall Street pornography and get the real romance?
Well, I think certainly you can go and do the source reading yourself if you're inclined to do so, and get the actual SEC filings from the companies and their annual reports. You can go to the websites and get all kinds of detail of what's in mutual funds and what they really charge, and if you understand that, that'll be helpful. But I think for the average person, it's sort of futile task. You're not going to be able to beat the averages over time. So for the average person, my recommendation is get a good group of low-cost index funds and use them and save the massive amounts of time you're going to spend trying to beat the professionals. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're saying there are these firms in Wall Street who invest thousands and thousands of hours and have thousands of employees, if you take the whole group of them, looking at all these companies trying to determine the value, and you can figure it out better than them? Pretty difficult. So I think you'd be better off trying not to do that and instead go the index fund route.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our time this afternoon at the Commonwealth Club where we have time for only one last question. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, our program today is Leland Faust speaking on how Wall Street is destroying America. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Leland, can you give us maybe a closing comment rather than a question just on how we can really take action and maybe answer the question, is the government in the back pocket of the banks? Do we really have freedom to try to make better regulations? And what action can we take?
Well, I think that we can take action if we choose to have our representatives know about these problems and deal with them. It does matter how they vote, and there have been changes in the past in Congress, some that have been very good, some that haven't been as successful. But I do think that's a very important route, and I think it probably, in the end, is going to be more effective than anything else. So I think that the individual withholding his funds, unless there's a massive campaign that's organized that actually makes sense, isn't likely to be effective. So I think it's getting our elected representatives to do the right thing, and then for them in the executive department to enforce things that make sense. But I think it's going to be difficult because of the great amounts of money that these firms have and are willing to spend to protect their turf.
Okay. All right, I'd like to thank our speaker, Leland Faust, again for being here today. We also want to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club as well as our audience listening at home. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.